The North Carolina Reading Service provides the following program for our blind and print-impaired audience. From our fall foliage hot air balloon tethered over our studio towers, John Feddersen will today read the Indie Week. Our issue, dated October the 19th of 2023, is our feature today. And from our hot air balloon, I can see over the fall foliage almost as far as the State Fair headquarters, which is now in full swing, and looking forward to a nice weekend of cool weather. And the management of our station, state-of-the-art station, has provided me with some nourishment. They've sent over a few sticks from the fair, of course, of deep-fried butter, and that's salted butter, apparently, and a Mount Olive pickle-flavored milkshake. And hope that I enjoy that. And again, I have to produce all my own hot air to stay afloat, and so I better just keep reading the Indie Week, and here we go. All right, well, municipal elections, early voting at any rate, has begun over a lot of the state. Chapel Hill, Orange County is no exception to those. And important deadlines to notice in this first article from Indie Week. A deadline to request a ballot by mail is October 31st of 2023, 5 p.m. November 4th. A deadline, 3 p.m., to register and vote at an early voting site. Now, early voting has begun. Proof of residency is required, it says. November 7th, of course, is general election. 5 p.m., the deadline to return all absentee ballots in person to the Board of Elections office. Vote on election day. Polls are open 6:30 a.m. to 7:30 p.m. Anyone standing in line by 7:30 p.m. is eligible for vote. To find your voting information, including location, sample ballot, history, etc., visit orangecountync.gov/voterlookup. And if you have not registered yet, there's an online portal. If you are a Department of Motor Vehicles customer, or you can submit a registration form to the Orange County Board of Elections. During early voting, you will need proof of residency and at any early voting site. Photo ID is required to vote. And there are several different versions of a photo ID, and you can get a free one by going to the Orange County Board of Elections. That office, 208 South Cameron Street in Hillsboro. And that Monday through Friday, they are open from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Now the article itself. From the Indy staff, for the last several years, the towns of Chapel Hill and Carrboro have found themselves mired in something like existential crisis. Caught between the desires of many residents to see the towns grow, modernize, and expand their tax base, the pushback from another contingent who would rather see them stay mostly the same has been fierce. It's a fight between those who would move forward and those who want to go back in time to an idealized version of the past, one that perhaps only ever existed in their minds. While the town has been making progress in the last few years and seems to be on the right track, that tension persists this election cycle, and the towns are at a crossroad once again. On the one side, progressive candidates favor innovations in the field of housing, transit, community spaces, and commercial development. They understand that homes in Chapel Hill and Carrboro are or are rapidly becoming out of reach for many, including young people, workers, and longtime residents of color. And they see that expanding the built environment is one way to address such disparities. On the other side, there's a preoccupation with parks and green spaces, of which the towns have plenty and are not in danger of losing. and a complacency about the reality that the area is becoming one that's unlivable for anyone but the rich. On both sides, there are dramatic levelings of PAC interference and dark money influence, as relationships between residents and their preferred slates of candidates have frayed. It's exhausting. And we haven't even mentioned the school board yet. We at Indy know where we stand going into these municipal school board elections, and that's with the candidates who favor progress, inclusiveness, and equity. A town can't be stuck in time. Progressive beacons of the South can't open their ranks to stealth Republicans. And absurd sums of money from the home-owning class shouldn't be able to dictate the direction of the future for groups of people who include students, renters, and public workers. So without further ado, here are our endorsements for Chapel Hill and Carrboro Mayor and Town Council, and two of four open seats on the school's Board of Education. Now, before continuing, I will just point out that I will not be reading the several paragraphs long endorsement texts, simply the names of the candidates which the Indy Week has chosen to endorse. And the first endorsement for Mayor of Chapel Hill, Jess Anderson, who they like. She's done two terms already on the town council, and we think she's the best choice to succeed Pam Heminger and continue that work from the top seat. On the town council, we approve Amy Ryan. While we don't agree with every decision she's taken, we think her knowledge and experience will serve a council well that will see at minimum three new members elected. Never hurts to have an independent voice at the table. Melissa McCulloch is a trained ecologist and career-long civil servant. Theodore Nollert is recommended, a grad student leader at UNC Chapel Hill. He stood out this campaign for his earnest desire to improve life in the town for residents, both current and future. Eric Valera is recommended as an executive at El Centro Hispano, the largest Latino-led serving organization in the state. An honorable mention of recommendations for Town Council, John Mitchell, chair of Chapel Hill Planning Commission since 2022. Over to Carrboro and recommendations. Mayor Barbara Fushi, running unopposed, but we're still happy to throw our support behind her. For the town council, Eleazar Posada, one of the youngest members, we support the re-election of Eleazar Posada. Catherine Frey has served on Carrboro's planning board since 2012, and we like her. Jason Merrill, the former owner of Bike Repair Shop, Back Alley Bikes. He's been on the Transportation Connectivity and Advisory Board. He's an endorsement from Indy Week. Now, for Chapel Hill Carrboro School's Board of Education, they did an admirable job this year prioritizing pay raises and benefits for the teachers and staff, but it could use some new leaders willing to test fresh, innovative ideas and expand the district's equity lens. And the two candidates that are recommended here, Ronnie Dussey, a member of the board since 2015, former chair and vice chair, has championed higher pay and staff for staff and overseen implementation of the district's five-year strategic plan. Then there's Barbara Feders, a UNC Chapel Hill law professor who directs the Youth Justice Clinic there, works with law students on behalf of court-involved young people who are indeed in need of resources, and support. And those are the Carrboro Chapel Hill recommendations and endorsements from Indy Week. There is a related article from Chase Pellegrini DePauw about, called Double Vision, about the Purple Bowl restaurant in downtown Chapel Hill. I will not read that article right now because it points up again this dividing line between what some residents want for Chapel Hill and other what others want as well. It's a three-pager. If I have time to read some of it at the end, I will. But I'm going to move on to some other items right now. But I'll continue with Chapel Hill and the Planning Commission, which has recommended moving forward with a Longfellow project. On Tuesday night, that commission voted to approve a new 9-story life sciences building on West Franklin Street. The developers behind the project, Boston-based Longfellow Real Estate Partners, have been continually updating the proposal since they introduced it to the Community Design Commission back in February. But they maintain that the facility would be around 150 feet tall with over 400,000 square feet to include first floor retail space, commercial wet labs, and offices. A Longfellow statement to the town council said the building would create, quote, space for hundreds of new jobs for office, research, life science, technology, etc., and opportunity for supporting jobs and existing businesses in the heart of downtown. But shovels are still a long way from hitting the dirt. The Planning Commission is an advisory body, meaning its only power is to provide recommendations to the town council. Still, all 7 board members who were present gave the project the green light. It is tentatively scheduled to appear on the town council's agenda October the 25th. Even if the council approves the project, construction would not start until early 2025. Now, some candidates for council and mayor have put the spotlight on the Purple Bowl restaurant, a current tenant on West Franklin, arguing that demolishing it would mark a dark turn for the college town. Others say the town needs the commercial tax revenue that would come from a Longfellow building. Town staff and members of the commission seem to be acutely aware of the extra layer of political scrutiny. A memo from town staff to the commission essentially told members to disregard public discourse about the Purple Bowl. The memo, signed by Brittany Waddell, Judy Johnson, and Toss Lagu, said, "The displacement of current tenants of the project site has been a major element of public conversation regarding the proposed development. Staff do not recommend the inclusion of any ordinance conditions regarding the displacement of current tenants." Still, Commission member John Mitchell, who's running for a seat on the council, asked Longfellow representatives about the elephant in the room and what authority the town might have to try to prevent the destruction of the current building. "Who owns the building?" Mitchell asked. "Longfellow owns the current building and several surrounding lots. According to real estate records, it purchased the property in 2022 for $3.5 million. Because Longfellow is making a zoning request to redevelop the nearly 2-acre property, town senior planner Toss Lagu said the council has limited options to try to somehow preserve the Purple Bowl. Lagu wrote, "The town's hands are, in my view, severely tied when it comes to requiring through zoning, really, anything related to the current tenants." The Purple Bowl has gotten more attention from politicians, but 306 West Franklin is also home to businesses including Bella Nail Bar, the Chimney Indian Kitchen, and Blue Dogwood Market. He pointed back to the staff memo for other levers the town could pull. The memo stated that Longfellow, quote, is working with current tenants to assist with relocation. The town also created a grant program to assist downtown businesses with relocation costs. In both Tuesday's presentation and an information meeting earlier this month, Longfield Communications Director Casey Angel promised that Longfellow would fill the first floor retail space with local businesses. Quote, You'll never find a Starbucks or a Subway in any of our projects throughout our entire international portfolio. We exclusively work with local retailers, and we foster these relationships, and so moving forward, folks like the Purple Bowl and Chimney are exactly who we want in our building moving long term. In their closing remarks, commission members tried to separate the politicization of Purple Bowl's potential demolition from the reality of their limited role as an advisory commission. Member E. Strother Murindinga said, "I think it's perhaps misunderstood or twisted in the public discourse about this project, especially with the upcoming local elections. The town of Chapel Hill is not evicting anyone from this property." And members also emphasized how the transformation of that area of Franklin Street could shape downtown Chapel Hill's future. Mitchell said, "I think most everybody wants the town to get more commercial development so that we can stop raising taxes. The town needs to move forward with its long-term vision for economic vibrancy of the downtown, and it's not clear what we could do or what would be reasonable for us to do to hold up a project to keep an existing tenant in place." And Murray Ndinga agreed. From a partnership with the Ninth Street Journal, on October the 12th, John Cooperschmidt has written "A Different Way to Vote. Durham locals pick winning projects totaling $2.4 million. With a series of community projects vying for a slice of the budget, $2.4 million of city funding is on the plate for Durham locals. Much like a diner selecting the most delicious dishes from a buffet, residents have the opportunity to pick the community projects they find most appealing. The participatory budget process introduces a curated menu of 10 projects, each with its own importance to the city. Now, the voting process, available both on paper and online, began Thursday, September 21st, and it ends soon, on Tuesday, October 31. All city residents can take part, including students 13 years or older. Andrew Holland, the assistant director with City's Budget and Management Services Department, says residents are encouraged to select the projects they feel most deserve support. And he says, "Having residents vote for what they believe the city should fund in their community gives them a real voice in local government decision-making process on how their tax dollars are put back into their communities." The menu of community projects, community projects prioritizes equity, Holland says, and ranges from playground improvements to safety measures. Then there is a list of the project proposals, which I will read, and they include, in no particular order, I think in terms of, pedestrian safety on East Trinity Avenue, close to $1 million for that. Safety measures like crosswalks, signage, and sidewalks. $888,000 for outdoor lighting for improved safety and extended hours at Maureen Road Park, Holton Career and Resource Center, and Edison Johnson Recreation Center parking lots. Playground improvements, total $760,000, a trio of shade structures, and two new playgrounds at Bay Hargrove Park, Carroll Street Park, and Southern Boundaries Park. Over at Duke Park, Skate Park, $350,000, a new skate park with movable equipment. Teen equipment at recreation centers totals $85,000. Improving equipment like computers and games at Durham Teen Center at Lion Park, Holton Career and Resource Center, Walltown Recreation Center, and W.D. Hill Rec Center and Weaver Street Rec Center. Crosswalks with murals spotlighting public art at numerous intersections, $352,000. At Cook Road Park, a bathroom, a new bathroom facility totals out at $330,000. Sustainable improvements to parks, that's $110,000 for installation of new water bottle filling stations, bike repair stations, and solar power charging stations for improving sustainability at various local parks. At Stagville Monument, $275,000, creation of an artistic and educational monument honoring the formerly enslaved people of the Stagville Plantation. And for the Durham Housing Authority properties, $110,000 for security measures, including cameras, deadbolt locks, and improved lighting at the Cornwallis Road Community and Price Steel Place. A short trip to my state-of-the-art calculator totals about $4,249,000 for those projects listed above. And remember, we have just $2.4 million of city funding is available. The article continues that the proposals are collected from one-time project ideas that residents submitted last year, a list that was winnowed to 10 by city staff together with a volunteer steering committee. Now, to take part, participants examine this list of potential projects and rank at least five of them in order of preference. For instance, a participant who selects all 10 projects is to rank them from 1 to 10. Once residents have chosen and ranked their projects, City Council will approve a final list of projects totaling that $2.4 million, and the winning proposals will be implemented in this coming winter. In 2019, the first cycle of these participatory budgeting funded 18 Durham projects like playgrounds, public art, and bus shelters. A second cycle saw the approval of $1 million for 22 organizations serving residents impacted by COVID and organizations addressing racial and economic disparities. More information is available on the program's website. And I imagine if one goes to IndieWeek.com and looks for this article, you'd see the links available. They don't do this in the printout that I get to read. And so, or the City of Durham would probably have this budget proposal of winning participatory voting projects. Next to Durham, and Durham Health Department, it says, will provide updated COVID vaccine to uninsured residents next week. That County Department of Public Health will begin providing this vaccine to uninsured and underinsured Durham residents aged 6 months or older. Appointments for insured residents are on pause for now. Here's what to know. Who's eligible? Appointments will be available to residents aged 6 months or older who do not have private health insurance coverage, Medicare or Medicaid, or whose health insurance does not fully cover the cost of this vaccine. How to make an appointment? They began taking appointments on October 16th, saying due to limited supplies, the health department will not accept walk-ins. But how to make that appointment? You may call 919-560-7658 to schedule an appointment. If slots are filled up, keep an eye on the public health website or Facebook page. They'll post an update as soon as more vaccines become available. What brand is the vaccine? Both Pfizer and Moderna will be provided. The supplies are limited. A choice of brand is not guaranteed. Why aren't appointments available for people with insurance? Durham County Department of Public Health so far only received COVID-19 through the Bridge Access Program and the Vaccines for Children Program. These two programs, which provide vaccines at no cost, do not allow their doses to be used for residents with insurance. The federal, by the way, federal public health emergency, which previously enabled residents to receive these vaccines, regardless of status, ended in May. And due to shipping delays, vaccines intended for insured residents have not yet come into stock, though public health anticipates that the doses will be available very soon. Where else can I get a vaccine? According to the Center for Disease Control's vaccine locators, COVID-19 vaccines are in stock at a number of Walgreens, Harris Teeter, and Costco pharmacies in and around Durham. And as the Indy reported last week, Durham resident Marcella Thompson has also organized vaccine clinics intended primarily for residents without insurance that will take place at the Walgreens at Fayetteville Street from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on these following days, November 4th, 5th, 11th, and 12th. Now, this long article here, it will take a good amount of time. I've just undertake to read it. A UNC student's overdose death at Duke. Police rushed into a residence hall on Duke University's Cligo Quad at about 6:30 a.m. on March 9th and climbed to the third floor of an old stone building around the corner from Duke Chapel. In room 309, they found a pale, chilled body in a puffy jacket on her back in a twin bed, glistening in a pool of sweat. The young woman was barely breathing. According to the 911 call log and an investigative report, a trash can set next to the bed. After almost an hour of treatment for cardiac arrest, an ambulance took Elizabeth Grace Burton, a business student from Charlotte and a member of Zeta Tau Alpha at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, to Duke University Hospital, and 2 days later she was pronounced dead. Burton was 19. A state autopsy says she died of cardiac arrest from a toxic mix of cocaine and alcohol. A private autopsy also found fentanyl and GHB, a depressant that can give feelings of euphoria. Until contacted by the Assembly, that's a publication that shared this article, Duke University and Chapel Hill said nothing publicly about the death. Duke said it deferred to UNC because Burton was a student there, and UNC said it considers the family's wishes when deciding to release a statement. No one has been charged with Burton's death, but her companion that night, former Duke student Patrick Rowland, has pleaded guilty to using a cell phone to facilitate the distribution of cocaine and marijuana. Rowland, age 22, is scheduled to appear in federal court on October the 18th, that just occurred, and will be sentenced in December. Rowland could face a civil suit from Burton's family. He is no longer at Duke, but Duke officials won't say whether he was expelled or left voluntarily. A Durham man seen on video carrying Burton to Rowland's dorm room earlier that morning, Cy Frazier, 45, has been charged with cocaine and fentanyl distribution, unlawful use of a communication facility, and possession of a firearm. Carlissa Allen, a Durham woman who prosecutors identified as his girlfriend in a criminal complaint, faces the same charges. Local federal prosecutors declined to comment on whether they will bring charges in Burton's death. Chris Atkins of Huntersville, the lawyer for Grace Burton's mother, said they hope federal prosecutors will charge Frazier with Burton's death in a superseding indictment, as they did in another death in March. The Burton family also wants Rowland to be charged in Burton's death and have hired a private investigator. Atkins said, "They're not investigating any of this stuff, and Duke doesn't want to. Someone took her body and hid it away in the dorm room for an hour while she died." Atkins said EMS personnel were unaware that Burton had used cocaine, which sometimes is laced with fentanyl. If responders had known, they could have administered Narcan or another type of naloxone that can reverse the effects of overdosing from an opioid like fentanyl. No one tries to administer Narcan because no one knows what they're doing, said Atkins. And she dies. A Duke student interviewed by the assembly disputed these allegations, saying that he was with Rowland when he told paramedics they had used cocaine. Burton's mother, Lisa Burton, declined a request for the interview. Rowland and his attorney declined to comment. Duke declined to respond to Atkins' allegations. So this article is based on interviews and a review of the 9/11 transcript, indictments, Frazier's detention order, autopsies, motions, and other court documents. Burton's death reveals an often hushed but extensive drug culture at two of the state's leading academic institutions. She's not the only UNC student who died of an overdose in recent months. WUNC reported recently that Dean Blackburn, the university's director of student wellness, told the UNCCH Board of Trustees that in the last 20 months, three students and one young alumnus died of fentanyl poisoning. In the days following her death, Grace Burton's peers flooded social media with hundreds of comments reminiscing about her sweetness. Thank you for how welcome you made me feel from the very beginning, one posted. Grace was such a sweet and kind girl in the short time I knew her. Burton, 5'8" and blonde, was the director of sisterhood for Zeta Tau Alpha, one of UNC's most coveted sororities. She'd been admitted into the undergrad program at Kenan Flagler Business School, according to her obituary. She and Rowland met on Tinder, according to Atkins and a friend of Rowland, who asked not to be named, to discuss a sensitive matter. The two messaged for several weeks before meeting for the first time during the early hours of March 9th, when Rowland went to Chapel Hill to pick her up. Rowland was a member of Duke's Alpha Tau Omega, a fraternity known for its love of country music, beer, and football. But his friend said the philosophy major preferred nights at home chatting or watching TV with friends. His family in West Virginia is working class, and he worked a number of service jobs in high school and college with stints as a pizza delivery boy and camp counselor. Since at least 2018, local university students have bought drugs from Frazier, who they called the barber, according to the detention order. The nickname emerged from his day job at the Lion's Den Barbershop and Hair Salon on Moorhead Avenue in Durham, now called Borders Barbershop. The detention order states Burton contacted Frazier after a party at UNC, intending to purchase cocaine. At around 4:30 a.m. on March 9, surveillance footage shows a blue Toyota RAV4 pull up next to Cligo Dorm, and Rowland told authorities that Frazier was the driver, and investigators recognized the car as his girlfriend. Rowland and Burton walked in the dark to the car, climbed in, and minutes later stepped out. Less than an hour later, Burton's legs began to fail her. She teetered back and forth until she and Rowland plopped onto a bench. Burton soon fell asleep. Rowland, loopy himself but conscious, phoned Frazier. The blue Toyota returned to the dorm at around 5:45, but this time Frazier jumped out. He found Burton draped over a bench outside of Kilgo with Rowland by her side and carried her body inside the dorm up a stairway and into Rowland's room, according to the detention order. After 6:15, a Duke student who lived down the hall says he awoke to a knock on the door. He opened it to find Rowland trembling as he explained what had happened. The student asked not to be named to discuss a sensitive matter. The student went to Rowland's room, where he said he saw Burton, her skin drained of color and barely breathing. Her eyes stayed shut, but her mouth had dropped open. Rowland and his roommate were in the room. The student called 911. The person on the line on speakerphone instructed them to move Burton on her side and take her pulse. The student described where paramedics should come, and two arrived within about 8 minutes. The paramedics asked which substances had been involved. Roland mentioned cocaine, according to the student who asked not to be named. Then paramedics shooed the students into the hallway. A swarm of campus police and a team of EMS arrived. Down the hall, Roland was shaking uncontrollably. Every few minutes, he rushed over to a trash can to throw up. Duke police executed a search warrant on the dorm room, but as of Friday afternoon, they had not filed their findings with the Durham County Clerk's Office. White powder found in Burton's phone case later tested positive for cocaine and fentanyl, court documents said. According to Fraser's detention order, when Burton was at Duke Hospital, an unidentified student called Fraser and asked if he knew Grace. Fraser said he did, and the student told him Grace had died and wanted to know what he sold her. Fraser hung up. The day before Burton was pronounced dead, another young adult died after buying drugs from Fraser, according to prosecutors. Joshua Zinner, 23, a former UNC at Wilmington student and Kappa Alpha fraternity brother living in Raleigh, had told his friends he was feeling sick, thought he had a sinus infection. A friend tried to check on him, but after a day with no response, he approached Zinner's roommate. The roommate opened the door to Zinner's bedroom, saw blankets and clothes piled on the bed, according to a report by the state medical examiner. Scattered across the mound were two small empty bags and a third filled with white powder. E-cigarettes were strewn throughout the space, and a bottle of over-the-counter nasal spray sat on the desk near unprescribed amoxicillin and prescribed trazodone, an antidepressant. The roommate stepped further into the room and approached the bed. There he found Zinner lying on his left side with his arms hanging above his head. His body was cold to the touch. Zinner was dead. He had a history of cocaine use and had attended rehab in the past, according to the report. His stated cause of death was cocaine and fentanyl toxicity. Text exchanges from March 4 indicate that Zinner purchased 2 grams of cocaine for $168 from Fraser. According to a court record, weeks earlier, Zinner had sent $165 to Fraser's wife, Keitra, on Cash App. His roommate told investigators the transaction was also a cocaine purchase. According to prosecutors, Fraser was married but also had a girlfriend. Fraser and his girlfriend, Allen, were later charged in connection with Zinner's death. Federal prosecutors have not explained why he has been charged in Zinner's death, but not in Burton's. Zinner wrestled at Raleigh's Broughton High School, played club soccer, and worked at Oakwood Pizza Box. He was an avid Carolina Hurricanes hockey fan who attended games with father and sisters. His obituary said, "Those who know him will be forever changed by his infectious personality, compassionate heart, and giving nature. A natural organizer of events and people, if there was fun to be had, you'd find Josh showing the way." Fraser did not always conduct business on his own. A U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration investigation into Fraser found. Sometimes, Allen delivered to his customers while Fraser communicated her whereabouts by text. On March 15, Allen drove her blue Toyota down the rocky hill that descends into the barbershop's dirt parking lot at 4:45 p.m., according to the detention order. She immediately turned around and exited, parking a block away. She waited up for about 15 minutes till Fraser walked out of the shop, sporting a black backpack, and slumped into the passenger seat. Then police surrounded the car. Fraser shoved the backpack toward Allen, burst out of the vehicle, and threw a cell phone beneath the car just before he was handcuffed. Officers then arrested Allen. A search of the car turned up a Glock 45 caliber handgun under the driver's seat. Inside the backpack, they found 7 grams of fentanyl, plastic bags of cocaine, a digital scale, and additional drug paraphernalia. Also $12,000 in cash. Fraser has been entangled with the law over a number of matters over the last 15 years, including possession of illegal substances. In 2014, convicted on two counts with intent to manufacture and deliver and sell a controlled substance, and put on probation until 2016. Frazier and Allen were both indicted on March 28 of four counts by a grand jury for the Middle District of North Carolina, including conspiracy to distribute cocaine. The court also added two new charges from March: possession with intent to distribute fentanyl, while in possession of a firearm. On August 28, the grand jury added a second superseding indictment alleging drug distribution by Frazier and Allen caused Zinner's death, which could result in a minimum sentence of 5 to 20 years. The pair has pleaded not guilty to all charges. Their attorneys declined comment. Even though they are being tied together, Allen's lawyer has motioned to prohibit the government from introducing evidence of drug overdoses from her case. They said Allen was not present during the deals that led to both deaths. Their trial is set for November the 13th. Rowland also faces federal charges, but not for Burton's death. Federal prosecutors filed against him on June 2nd for unlawfully using his cell phone to facilitate the distribution of marijuana and cocaine. When Rowland consented to have his phone searched, authorities found 1,140 text exchanges with Frazier. Rowland was accused of buying and supplying cocaine and marijuana to other students over a period of about 7 months, from September 22 to March 23. In total, Rowland purchased 7.5 grams of cocaine and 29 ounces of marijuana from Frazier. Rowland pleaded guilty on June 8th. The court set his sentencing for September 22nd with a $50,000 unsecured bond, but the hearing has been postponed until December 12th, after the Burtons' attorney filed a motion under the Crime Victims' Rights Act to establish themselves as victims in the case. If they are designated as victims, prosecutors would be required to notify the family of hearings and enable them to make impact statements, which a judge could consider in sentencing. A hearing on that motion is scheduled yesterday. Under the plea bargain, Rowland faces up to 4 years in prison and $250,000 in fines. Atkins, the Burton family lawyer, said the family approached local prosecutors in Durham about bringing charges against Rowland and Frazier, but Atkins said Duke police had not thoroughly investigated, making it difficult for prosecutors to bring charges. Atkins said the North Carolina Medical Examiner's autopsy conducted by Dr. Kimberly Jensen was botched because it left out key substances that contributed to Burton's death. Atkins alleges the autopsy relied on the blood drawn by Duke University at 8:02 a.m. on March 9, before Burton was declared dead. He said the results would have been more accurate if blood had been drawn after her death. Even though fentanyl was detected in Burton's urine sample taken at the same time, fentanyl was not listed as a contributor to Burton's death. Jansen concluded that Burton died of ethanol and cocaine toxicity. Her blood level was 0.189, more than twice the legal limit for driving. Jansen did not respond to requests for comment. The Burton family hired a private pathologist, Robert Thomas of York Pathology Associates, to conduct an autopsy and toxicology report. His report found fentanyl, norfentanyl, and GHB, in addition to alcohol and cocaine, and concluded that Burton died of a multi-drug overdose. The last known on-campus death at Duke occurred in 2021 in November. A man who is not a student was found dead near a building across from the Kilgo Residence Hall. Duke Today reported the incident later that day, but most students found out this via word of mouth. Duke said it communicates publicly when one of its own student passes away, but the university's response varies when a visitor dies. Frank Trimble, Duke's vice president for communications, said via email, "In this particular case, the student who passed away was a member of the UNC community, and therefore, communications regarding her death were handled by UNC." Duke declined to comment on Roland leaving the university, citing federal privacy laws that govern universities. UNC did not announce the death earlier. According to the student death protocol at UNC campus, police only send out an alert if there is a threat to others on campus, but will exclude the cause of death. Chloe McCotter, media relations manager for the university, said in an email, "These messages can be triggering for members of our community and are often more harmful than helpful." UNC, quote, "respects the privacy of the deceased student's family and takes into consideration their wishes regarding notification of family and friends and their desire to make difficult personal decisions about public announcement." There is no standard policy for how universities handle deaths. Simon Barker, a higher education consultant, said universities often don't announce overdoses. Their primary responsibility is communicating with the family of the deceased, particularly as overdoses are soaring and most of the resulting deaths involve fentanyl. Said Simon Barker, "it's an epidemic, and it's occurring all the time. I think that sensitivity is important." Now I have 11 minutes remaining, and I'm going to go on to another heartbreaker, this one titled "The Heartbreak of College Suicides," and it's from Raleigh. And it's by Jade Neptune, and I will not, on all probability, won't have time to read it, but we'll see. "Benjamin, no." It was only two words, a phrase that was probably uttered dozens of times over Ben Salas's 21 years of life, but on the afternoon of April 26, 2023, it was a text message no parent ever wants to send, the last one. Tony Salas texted in response to his youngest son's message that he was going to take his life. Ben, who was finishing his junior year at NC State, was a talented athlete on the varsity rifle team, a gifted student, an aspiring Olympian, and a beloved brother, son, boyfriend, and teammate. He was close with his parents by all accounts, and they did everything they knew to do to raise emotionally healthy children, and still, he was battling himself in secret. In the 2022-23 academic year, the families of seven North Carolina State University students said goodbye to their children after they took their own lives. Ben Salas was one of them. "Tony Salas told me," writes Jade Neptune, the author, "that, it seemed like a normal day. That's a terrifying truth for many parents who have lost their children to suicide, which is the third leading cause of death among individuals between 15 and 24 years of age." Tony Salas lives in Gastonia. The program manager on T-Mobile's project engineering and development team talked with his son nearly every day, including at about 3:30 on that April afternoon. A friend of Ben's had died by suicide a few days earlier. Salas says, "I wanted to make sure he was doing okay. He said he was fine." But less than 3 hours after assuring his dad he was okay, Ben decided to take his own life. And 5 months later, Tony Salas still has no idea why. He says, "there are the typical signs you are taught or learned to look for, you know, depression, withdrawal, appetite, mood swings, all those sort of red flag indicators that would normally be cause for concerns. You don't see that." And Ben was proof of that. There were no signs that Ben was struggling mentally. Absolutely zero. The 7 suicides at State last academic year marked an alarming increase. The university averaged 3 student suicides a year in the previous 5 years. Of the 7, 3 were students at the College of Engineering. 7 other State students died last year of other causes, including 2 who died of a drug overdose. Already this fall, 1 student has died on campus. The student's body was found on Labor Day outside a 12-story dorm. State has not identified the student or provided the cause of death. State has more than 35,000 students, and while the university has struggled to address the rising number of mental health-related deaths with additional counselors and other initiatives, even experts are at a loss for answers. Mark Kulikowski, a university spokesman, said, "Our students and students across the country face many difficult stressors. Academics may certainly be one, but they also may be navigating relationships, peer pressure, identity, substance abuse, the impacts of that pandemic, and more. As an institution, we try to cast a wide net for support, provide resources, and generate awareness of available help on campus and in our broader community," end quote. And I'll just pause here for a second to mention, this article mentions suicide. If you or someone you know is having suicidal thoughts, there is a suicide and crisis lifeline. And that phone number is very simple, 988, Suicide and Crisis Hotline. Jonathan Abramowitz, director of the Clinical Psych Training Program at UNC Chapel Hill, says there are many reasons for students to experience anxiety, which is a scientific reaction to perceived threats. But for high-achieving students like Salas, the transition may be more difficult to notice. Abramowitz says, "What we see again and again is people who are so caught up in this narrative of, well, they were so successful. They had such a clear path. They knew where they were going. They had goals. All these different things of these really high accomplishing individuals who are young and struggling with mental health. Success can be a mask for mental health struggles across every group." But the adolescent and young adult, the young adult brain is less equipped to handle and process perceived failures. They kind of skate through middle school, high school. Things might come easy to them. And then when they're in college, Abramowitz said, things are a little bit different. You're independent. You're on your own. The bar gets raised a little bit higher. There's more stakes. It's your future. Failure, unexpected challenges, and disappointment are unavoidable obstacles in life, and yet many young adults are unprepared to address them, especially those who have a record of succeeding. This makes a college campus like State or UNC Chapel Hill, which had 4 student suicides in 2021, a breeding ground for undetected mental health challenges. Now, the author, Jade Neptune, writes, "Ben Salas was successful and surrounded with love, friends, family, and mentors, and yet he was silently struggling. I was, too. When I was only 16, I decided to graduate from high school early and applied to 2 highly selective universities, UNC Chapel Hill and Duke. The summer before my junior year of high school, my last year, I sat down to write my 600-word personal statement for the common application. The prompt read, quote, 'The lessons we take from obstacles we encounter can be fundamental to later success. Recount a time when you faced a challenge, setback, or failure. How did it affect you, and what did you learn from the experience?' I didn't know at 16, or even now at 20, if I'm being honest, that the biggest challenge, setback, or failure you've ever known isn't supposed to be yourself." quote, "I don't live a life where breathing comes easy." I didn't mean for it to be scary like I knew my parents would think it was, or off-putting or concerning like my teachers said college admissions officers would think it was, but it was true. I don't live a life where breathing comes easy, and I never have. I was admitted to college at 16, graduated from high school, top of my class at 17, and graduated from UNC Chapel Hill at 19. I ran my first political campaign before I could vote, celebrated my 20th birthday as a full-time member of the UNC School of Law staff, and have marked major life accomplishments before I could even legally drink. But I have done it all breathlessly, with three clinical diagnoses weighing on my chest: general anxiety disorder, panic disorder, and obsessive compulsive disorder. I've strived to be the first, only, and best for as long as I've dreamt of anything, but all my dreams have come down to the same principal factor. If I was those things, I wouldn't be me. It wasn't that I didn't believe I deserved the success I had. I'd worked hard and tirelessly. I had earned it. But I thought I would feel better once I achieved those things. In reality, the pain and uneasiness that fueled my achievements were the core of who I was. Without it, I was untethered and afraid. I didn't have a name for it in fourth grade, where I was so afraid to go to school that I threw up every morning in the car line. Or in middle school, where I couldn't stand the idea of anyone seeing me eat, so I ate in empty classroom and told my teacher I had an elephant sitting on my chest. Or in high school, when I hyperventilated in the bathroom, dubbed a chihuahua by my teachers and friends, and frankly, it didn't matter. I was outrunning my own wellness, an inevitable downfall, but I was also outpacing failure, imperfection, and disappointment. I couldn't reconcile that the same characteristics that gave me the power to be everything I was supposed to be, focused, driven, and seemingly perfect, were the same that made me miserable. I couldn't understand how my strengths were also symptoms of sickness. If they were treated, where would I go? Who would I be? Now I must bring this article to close and the edition of Indie Week, which will be available as a podcast on ncreadingservice.com. The proud providers of this service, and me, John Fetterson, to you. And as I slip my butter-covered palms down the guy ropes for my hot air balloon, I can only say I'm grateful for that pickle milkshake that helped me deliver that much-needed buoyancy to my reading today. Be with you next week with another edition of Indie Week. And so long, and thanks for listening, everybody.